It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 474. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Is brought to you in part by Instant House Call. Remotely support your customers unattended and on demand through firewalls. Try it free by clicking on the link on my website at miketechshow.com. Use the promo code MikeTechShow. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and staying subscribed to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for show topics at miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number is 240-949-2450, and that's Mike Tech Show, all one word, on Skype. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MikeTechShow. Follow me and like the Mike Tech Show Facebook page, and that is facebook.com/MikeNationNet, all one word. And don't forget the wiki at mtswiki.com. There you'll find links to all of the past shows, the audio, the show notes for every show going back all the way to show number one. I have a jam-packed show with a ton of tips and stories for working with clients the past week and why I've been just so crazy busy. And I want to share with you server migrations that I've been going through. So we're going to talk a lot about Windows Server 2012. And I have a client story where I was installing access points for better Wi-Fi access. I have some Gmail tips. A Windows 8.1. I've actually been playing with some comments on iOS 7 that I deployed last night, and a laptop annoyance that was just driving me crazy. And wouldn't you know it, a couple clients had the same problem, totally different laptop. Lots to get to tonight, and we're going to begin with really why I had to cancel last week's show. I rarely stack this much work over only a couple days. I had a server migration from a workgroup server to a domain controller with a client on Thursday and Friday. And they have a big point of sale application that had to be migrated and the data migrated. Then a true domain migration on Saturday, where I have two servers and one domain, and I needed to combine the data and migrate them to a totally brand new server and domain. And the operating systems were Windows Server 2012. And there's a lot of different editions for 2012. So one client, I deployed the Essentials version. Another client, I deployed the standard version, and I want to go over some of the differences. A great website, believe it or not, for really Wikipedia, gives the most complete breakdown of all of the differences of Server 2012. You have Foundation, which is really for OEMs only, and you have Essentials, Standard, and Data Center. So for the typical user, it's really Essentials or Standard. And I deployed Essentials for my one client. This is the replacement, or supposed to be the replacement, for Small Business Server. But you know what? It really isn't a complete replacement. Small Business Server 2003, 2008, and then the final version was Microsoft's Small Business Server 2011. It included SharePoint, it included SQL, and it also included Exchange Server. Well, that's not the case for 2012 Essentials. It's really just a print and file server with a domain controller. They completely automate the entire installation process, Microsoft does. And this is on a Dell server. And when I booted it up, it was really the first time, by the way, for both of these flavors of 2012 that I've actually worked with in a production environment for rolling out. And Essentials came up with just a couple questions. Literally, you pick the domain name, you pick an administrator password, and 45 minutes later, you have a domain controller. It just keeps installing everything. It picks an IP address and takes it and makes it static. So I had to make sure to go into the router and exclude that IP address. And now I'm fighting two DNSs going on. So I had to make sure that the DNS of the domain controller was the ruling one, because it can get ugly if you have Active Directory running and you are announcing a workstation to that domain and you don't have the right DNS, it'll take forever to boot. After I seen that everything was installed and happy and working, I began promoting all the workstations and announcing them to the domain. Because once we add them to the domain, now we can run the software from that domain, where I was able to migrate the POS software. So we had to time this very carefully. So Thursday was really the deployment of the server, and then I picked one XP workstation and made sure that it would connect. Now, so I wouldn't take my client down from using the POS software on all of their systems, we had someone from, actually a reseller from the point of sale software, was out to help with the data migration. So we picked a time like 3 to 5. We started the data migration while everybody exited the software. While that was going on, my son and I started announcing all the systems to the domain so we could then time this properly. So when the software was migrated, everybody was up on the new domain. So that went well. I mean, there really wasn't any issues. So that was like a 2-day, 5-6 hours each day making that happen. We're happy. Everything's good on Friday night. Saturday, I begin a brand new domain migration for another client. Only this one, I was using Microsoft Windows Server 2012 standard. And there's a big difference. Essentials, you have no control. You are a domain controller. You have no control over any of the services that you're going to deploy or shut down. That's it. You take it or leave it for all of your server options. The standard version, you get to build it up from scratch. You want Active Directory, or it can be a workgroup server. Any services that you want to deploy, you can pick and choose. So you have total control over 2012 standard. I deployed this particular flavor for this client because there is the potential that we could have SQL running down the road or different applications. I wanted full control and the ability to pick and choose any services I wanted, where the other small business, I knew I could get away with just Essentials. There's a limit of 25 users where you can have more for standard. It just made sense to have Essentials for the one client and now standard for this other client. The big hurdle on the second migration on Saturday was the copying of their data from the one server to the new server. Now, this is a two-server setup where there's just a few files, and it used to be an Exchange server that last year I migrated them to ShareWeb in the cloud for Exchange-hosted services. The other server was their main file and print server. It was also Small Business Server 2003. So it was pretty old, both boxes, both of them out of warranty. So it was time to move on to a new server with fresh warranty from Dell, an operating system that wasn't going to be end of life soon. So now I'm copying what looked like just 45 gig. Hey, that's no problem, right? That's not a lot of data. Well, what was making up that 45 gig was 125,000 small files. That's right, 125,000 files. You know how long it takes to copy 125,000 files? It takes 5 hours, and I learned that the hard way. By using just regular, you know, I just copied the directories over, I was able to leave. My son and I were able to get lunch. We came back over to my house because they're only a couple minutes away, and we were able to relax. I remoted in because one of the first things I did was install remote access on the server. I remoted in to keep an eye on the progress. When the copying was finishing, right at the end, there were many errors where I had to skip a file and skip a file and keep going. And it could not read the source directories because the combination of the paths of all of the folders and subfolders was too long for the copy process to handle that. It was more than 255 characters when you look at the nested folders of all of these files. There were 6,000 files that could not copy. Why do I not listen to myself? If you remember, even just not too long ago, I had another project where I told everybody, don't use the normal copy and paste command when you're doing a migration like this. Use a program like Syncback, some kind of a tool that can manage it and document files that don't copy. I don't know why I didn't do it. So now that I got all these files that didn't migrate, I pull out Syncback. The Syncback free version does not work with Server 2012. So I pull out my Syncback Pro, I install it, I set up the left side to copy the source server, the right side, the target server, do a sync. And it comes up and it lists 6,000 files and reports back to just click this one button to copy all of the files from the left to the right. I click it. Absolutely, I want to do that. All the files copy in a matter of minutes. So I was very impressed at how Syncback Pro saved me. That was great. I'm never going to leave home without it. Anytime I got a big copy to do, I am absolutely using that software. Love it. Now that I got everything copied, I begin the profile migration. I didn't have this trouble with the other company because they were just a work group. So I wasn't moving from one domain to another, so the profile issue was not as complex. Here, I have to take a system, drop them from the domain and make it a work group, and then promote them to the new domain. Now, there's a couple gotchas here that I want you to be aware of when you're doing this. Make sure that the local accounts on a system that's on the old domain, reset the local password to those accounts, the administrator account and a local system account. Just make sure you set the password. Just reset it to the word password. When you change from a domain to a work group on Windows 7, you're not allowed to switch users. That option's actually missing. You are presented with the original local account that you set the system up with. And you have to know that password. And if you don't know that password, you're not getting in. That's why in my instructions, I made sure to reset that password. Once you log in, now I can announce that system to the new domain with the domain administrator credentials. Now I can log off, log in as the domain administrator, and make that domain account that I just created for that user a local administrator on that machine. All the network administrators that are listening to this, they understand exactly what I'm talking about. I have to document this process because there's an additional challenge. I only have two desktops there. There are 9 laptops of users that are connected to that server, but they are traveling constantly. And they're not going to be there. But, matter of fact, it's going to be staggered. So I have to document the procedures for doing this domain migration as they come in. Now, there's an administrative assistant that I spent Monday morning with taking one of the laptops and going over step by step so she would know how to do this and then duplicate it as systems came in and as someone would come into the local office. I used FABS Auto Backup for Tech for migrating the files. All I did was run that and copy it to a local directory on the hard drive. We had plenty of space. I copied the Outlook PSTs where they were archived folders. I let FABS Auto Backup copy everything, but when it came to restore, I did not restore all of the files because when you have an OST file, it will not migrate if the profile is a different name. Here's what this means. Let's say your account name is Mike and the domain is ABC, the old domain. The profile name on the machine is Mike.abc. And your Outlook OST files, which is your offline storage files, are stored for that profile. If you create a new profile under the new domain, and let's say that's DEF, my new profile is Mike.DEF, and you can't marry that OST in Outlook. So I had to recreate the Outlook profile connecting to the Exchange hosted services. So that was an extra step. So all these steps, once I document it, it sounds horrible, but it was actually not bad. And it's not a bad process. And when I went over this with the owner and the admin assistant, they handled it pretty well. As a matter of fact, I stopped in today where they had done more than half of the migrations already as employees were trickling in from traveling. And they were doing a great job. They only had like one or two questions for me, and I was able to handle that. So that migration went very well, except for QuickBooks. Guess what? QuickBooks 2011, when you set up the database manager on the server for hosting QuickBooks data, well, QuickBooks 2011 does not work with Windows Server 2012. So we're finding a lot of things don't work. They had to upgrade to QuickBooks 2013, and it installed beautifully. Now, the first thing when you log in after the installation of the operating system, you are left with no start menu, and you're left with an interface that looks just like Windows 8. I don't know why, in Microsoft's wisdom, why would they inflict that kind of pain on us at the server level. That makes no sense. So here's the links that I'm providing for tonight. The one link that I think you're going to like is how to give Windows 2012 users a traditional user experience. So this way you have a fighting chance of using the server operating system. I mean, you can certainly figure everything out and get used to it, and I'm now getting used to it. I don't like that Metro interface. I certainly don't like it on a server. Are we really going to have touch screens at a server? I don't think so. I don't want a touch screen in my data center or at the server, and I believe that all of my clients would agree. It just doesn't make sense. When you're working with Windows 8 and Server 2012, keep in mind the keyboard tips, because they're going to save you, like Windows R to bring up run. So now I could type CMD and I could type ipconfig/all and see that, make sure that all the settings are correct. That was another challenge on the workstations when I was migrating. I was working with a lease from DHCP from the old domain. Even though I shut off the DHCP services, it still had that lease. I had to do an ipconfig/release and then ipconfig /renew in order to get the machine to find the new DHCP server. Another tip, we were only using one NIC. The server came with two NICs, and when I was trying to set up DHCP services, I could not get that working properly until I disabled the second NIC. Now, if I was going to team them together and bond those two NICs, you know, for failover, I would have been okay. But keep that in mind. If you're working with multiple NICs and you're having issues, you're better off, if you're not going to use or deploy that second NIC, disable it. Once I disabled it, DHCP started working, and I was able to authorize the one true network controller as the DHCP controller. I'm trying to think what else I learned from these migrations. Have a plan. Put together a list of everything that you need to think about, whether it's the DNS setup, DHCP. Do you have, you know, multiple NICs that you got to worry about? Make sure you review your procedures from dropping from a domain to a workgroup and then back to the new domain so you don't forget anything. Just keep writing that out. And that's what I prepared for myself. So I didn't really run into any problems that, you know, except for those, the files not copying, and Syncback Pro took care of that. Everything went pretty, you know, according to plan, everything that I had hoped. Monday morning, everything went well. When the users came in, there was no issues, and I went through the training, like I stated. So that was pretty good. But as you can see, that consumed all of my time and attention while I was unable to do a show last week. Let's move on to some other stories for the week. On Tuesday of last week, I was at a new client that me, my son Ryan, and my electrician was at the house installing four new access points for complete Wi-Fi coverage for the whole house. They had a couple. One network line was bad. Another one, the router wasn't configured correctly. And I just came in with all new MediaLink routers, set them up as access points, dining room, family room, kitchen, bedrooms. These were the areas. Matter of fact, my electrician still has to go back and install another Cat 6 line. He verified the lines, fixed the lines that had issues, and I configured all the routers. Now, as I was doing this, my client, they're older, about 60 years old, and the couple, and the wife of my client was entertaining a friend. And they were in the kitchen, and as I was going past, I heard the friend of my client's wife. She said, "Why are all these people here, and what are they doing for you?" My client's wife responded, "They're fixing our internet access and helping improve our access to the internet throughout the house. They're setting up access points." Her friend said, "What is the internet?" Now, I did everything I could to hold in and not laugh, but hearing someone ask an individual, "What is the internet?" I was really waiting for the response. How was my client's wife going to respond? to this request. And I was all ears, and I heard her say, "Dear, you don't have to worry about it." And that's how she explained the internet. Because I wanted to know. I was like, that would have been kind of cool how someone was going to explain the internet to someone. So there are still a lot of people out there, to my surprise, that have no idea what the internet is. Because I thought to myself, you know, it would be very interesting if I'm in a position to explain that. And I was wondering how I would even answer that for someone to understand just what the internet is. This was very funny. Matter of fact, I'm going to be back there on this Sunday following up where I have a new system to install and a multifunction printer we have to get. I'm going to guide my client through a new iPhone purchase where we're backing, making sure all of his apps and all of his files are backed up to iCloud and restored properly to his new iPhone 5S that he's purchasing on Sunday. I'm going to assist him with that. Now, speaking of that, iOS 7 came out last night, and I deployed it in probably about a half hour it took on my iPad 2. When I deployed it and set off the install on my iPhone, and I have an iPhone 5, well, that took a couple hours because Apple must have been just crushed with requests for installing the new operating system. So here's my tips and my first thoughts on this on iOS 7. First, make sure that you have a very good Wi-Fi connection and that your iPhone or iPad is powered. Make sure it's plugged in and getting juice because you don't want to have this run out of power in the middle of an upgrade. Because it could take a while. Second, make sure you close all of your existing apps. So do a double tap on the start button and hold down the app, the first app. You get a little minus sign. Hit the minus sign on all the apps. Now go into settings, general, software update, and begin the update process. When the update was finished, when I first looked at iOS 7, I wasn't very impressed. As a matter of fact, I don't like the interface. Since then, one feature has grown on me, and I really like it. If you do a finger gesture by going up from the bottom on the iPhone, you will have you're presented with a really nice menu, and the menu is your control of your networking. Wi-Fi, you can turn on and off. You can turn on and off Bluetooth. Your brightness. Your volume. You got a quick music control. And you got your AirDrop and AirPlay option. You get the built-in flashlight. So you have an option, a button for that. A button for your clock. A button for the calculator. And a button for the camera. So that's a real nice option that I like that screen to bring up the control and the interface for those particular features because I use them a lot. Clearly, Apple understands their user base that they're going to use them a lot, and it's really nice. Couple other tips. When you double tap your start button, you now get all of the apps that are open, and you can now scroll through them. To close an app, you have to hold it with your finger and push it up and off the iPhone, up to the top. Slide the app up, and now that app will close. So you're basically telling it to go away, and you hold it, swipe it up, and the app will close. And you can do that for each of your apps. So that's how you close it. If you want to search, you used to have to swipe to the right, and the far right there was a screen for searching. Now you can search from any screen, and all you do is hold and kind of pull down the whole screen from the top, and you get a search bar. the title bar they made very, very small. It's real tiny, so they give you some more screen real estate. I still don't really like all of the icon changes that they made and the color palette and their selections. It's interesting. I know I'll get used to it. I think it's chewing battery faster, iOS 7, so I have to take a look at what default features were turned on that I don't need. So keep an eye on that. I noticed my battery degraded very quickly today, quicker than normal. I got to go through some of those location services and things that are churning away and eating up the battery. So look for that. I will list two websites that I found last night to help me get started with iOS 7. A real good one is from Macworld, and that's Get to Know iOS 7. They do a great job, and it's how I learned a lot of these tips. That's the link for that. Another link I found is a few tricks that all new iOS 7 users should know, and this is from TechCrunch, two really great resources that you can check out that I think you should go through if you are deploying iOS 7. So this way you become familiar with all the features. That's the first thing you're going to wonder. Some things that you are used to doing with your old version of the iOS, it's changed. So it's going to be a little different. And that's what I found right away. And I had to search quickly. All right, so that takes care of iOS 7. Next thing I want to discuss, a laptop annoyance that I've had. Since I've been using my laptop more and more, as I've been spending a lot of hours on site with one particular client, and I'm doing a lot of writing, every time I'm in Excel or I'm doing a lot of typing, words would jump. I mean, I'm typing in something in one cell and it would jump to another cell. Or I'm writing something in Evernote and all of a sudden I'm up and I'm in the middle of another sentence and everything gets garbled and the cursor's jumping. And I hate touchpads and I'm using an external mouse, but I'm still having this jumping. I noticed as I was Googling for an answer here that I never installed the touchpad drivers for my laptop. This is a Lenovo laptop. And once I got the software and installed it, there's an option that you have to turn off. And it's the only way you can get to this option and turn it off. You have to have the driver installed. This is the tap option. Disable it. Since I've done this on my laptop, I no longer have the cursor jumping. I've had this now happen to two other clients since I solved it for myself. I've now solved it for two clients with totally different laptops. One was a Dell and another one was a ThinkPad. We had to install the touchpad drivers and then disable the tap. One of my clients, I remember way back when he was having a problem, he made me said, Mike, he said, just let's get rid of the touchpad completely. I don't like recommending that because I warned him that there would be a problem that if he ever opened up his laptop and he didn't have his external mouse and he disabled his touchpad completely, you're in trouble. You have to have an external mouse. He says, oh, I'll always have an external mouse. I remember this a year ago. He called me up and he was traveling. He's in California, and he says, Mike, I don't have my mouse with me, and I can't navigate. I don't have a mouse. I said, you have to get one. I said, remember, we disabled the touchpad. This is the result. You always have to have that external mouse. So be careful. Although you want to disable the touchpad, even if you hate it, I don't recommend doing that. But if you disable the tap function, you'll be a lot happier when you're typing. Some more tips for Gmail. I don't know, it was a month or so ago, Gmail started pushing these categories for promotion and social. And, you know, when you're on your Gmail for the web, you get these categories that I could care less about. And if you're in my boat and you don't like that, if you go to the little gear up on the right-hand corner of the website for Gmail, you click that and you have settings. You can go into settings. There's an inbox option. And when you look at the inbox settings, you can change the settings for categories and uncheck grouping your email into those categories. Something else I don't like. I don't like Google telling me what emails that it interprets as important, because I may not think it's important. And they would always mark emails important that to me weren't important. You can turn that off by clicking for importance markers, check no markings. There's another little tweak you can do for the look and feel of how many messages that they're going to display on the screen. In the settings, there's a display density option, and there's only three choices: comfortable, cozy, and compact. Now, I like the compact because I want as many messages as I can in the shortest area, and they compact it, and everything kind of spreads out and gets smaller. You might want to look at all of them. It makes the change very quickly, but it could make your experience more pleasant. And that's what this is all about. All of these tips and fixes and tweaks, tweaks for Windows 8, tweaks for Windows Server 2012, for Gmail, for laptops. It's to make the user experience better. And when you're in a position to have this knowledge to recommend these changes, like a couple weeks ago, my Office 2013 tips, that's what this is all about. So you can make the user experience, maybe it's a client, maybe it's a coworker, friend, family, whoever you're helping, help them have a better user experience, or maybe it's just for yourself. You make it more usable, more palatable, you're going to use the system more, and you're going to become more productive along the way. I know I have with my laptop, just by some of the tweaks that I've been doing. I enjoy using the machine a lot more. Now, something else last week, I needed to purchase Adobe Acrobat 11 Professional. There's some advanced functionality within PDFs that I want to do, combining PDFs in Outlook where you can group them together. I need to be able to do some forms and editing PDFs. And as you know, that software is very expensive. I'm going to endorse a website here where I purchased the full version, and I was afraid to do this, so I made sure to use PayPal. It's topsoftdeals.com. And I was very leery. I want to let you know that I successfully purchased Adobe Acrobat 11 Professional for Windows. They also have for Mac for $171. I received a download link and a legitimate key that I was able to register. And I am very happy to be able to save $250 on the software. I'm always leery about sites that offer discounted software like that, because is it legitimate? Are you going to get burned? And I was very careful. I made sure to use the PayPal account, and everything checked out and authorized. So I figured I would share that. A great way of saving money when you need some professional software and it's very expensive. Take a look, because as you know, the whole Adobe CSX suite is extremely expensive, and you may want to take advantage of some of their prices there. I still recommend using PayPal, because they can come to the rescue if you don't, if you get burned. At least you have a place to go. They can pull that money for you. PayPal's pretty good at that, where if you don't receive the product and they will make it good because they can reach in and take the money right from that vendor, and you can file the claim. So I felt pretty confident using my PayPal account to purchase that, and I just wanted to share that. Great way of saving a lot of money on some software, but again, you got to be careful. The last thing I want to cover, as busy as I've been the last couple weeks, I found time to deploy Windows 8.1, the final release, on one of my older laptops. I have TechNet, and as you know, TechNet's going to be going away. Well, just an FYI, anybody that has a TechNet subscription, they've added 90 days to the end of the expiration of your subscription. So that's just an FYI. Like, mine was scheduled to end in April 2014, so I'm going to get 3 more months. So they've added 90 days to the life of TechNet. I hope Microsoft changes their mind there. They do not do away with TechNet. I think it's a mistake that they're taking that away. For this great example, they deploy the RTM version of Windows 8.1 that's released to manufacturing. Windows 8.1, it's finalized. They make it available for MSDN and TechNet subscribers. So I can download it and now play with it. And here I am talking about it. If I don't have TechNet, I'm not getting that RTM release. And I don't know if I'm even going to discuss it. So I pick a laptop that's been sitting around for a while with no use, and I had no real data that I cared about on it. And this is one of those laptops that I purchased very inexpensively on a Black Friday a couple years ago for like $299 from Staples. It's an HP with an AMD processor, 4 gigs of memory, but I did add an SSD drive last year. I deployed Windows 8.1. Perfect. It installed very, very fast. And I'm like looking for the new features. And one of the things I seen was they added the start menu. So I look at that start menu, but it's not the start menu that we really want. Microsoft really didn't give us back the full start menu. You're still going to end up deploying the classic shell. And that's a free implementation of our start menu that we want. So I still had to deploy that. I was impressed that I didn't have to download any drivers. Everything worked. My network printing worked perfectly. My wireless, everything was great. Your mileage is going to vary depending on what hardware that you install it on. But there's no great big bells and whistle changes for 8.1. If you're using Windows 8, you might as well deploy it because it's like a service pack, only they're not calling it a service pack and they've added some features. I think you should install it. If you are Windows 7 and now you see 8.1, I still don't think there's a compelling reason to go to it. That being said, out of all the operating systems that's out there, Windows 8 is significantly faster than Windows 7. When you're running with it, it's very, very fast. The code is lean and mean, and everything executes at an incredible rate, and it performs beautifully with an SSD drive. So if you have a laptop or a system and you're thinking of doing a major upgrade and you want some performance increase, going with an SSD, and if you have the hardware to support Windows 8, I would go to it and then add that classic shell to get your start menu back, and you're going to be okay. All your software is going to work. The big difference is Internet Explorer, and you know, you can always install Firefox and run the normal way. You have to get used to programs versus apps, and that's a big change that I talked about a while ago with Windows 8. Apps are the Metro interface, where it looks like child blocks, and you see that on a lot of the ads on TV for the tablet and the Microsoft phone. You see this interface that is crying out for a touchscreen. So of course a tablet or a phone, no problem. But if you don't have a touchscreen on your desktop, you're not going to really use the Metro interface that much. At least I don't think you can fully take advantage of its features. They are apps. The traditional programs, once you get your start menu back, are programs. And one of the things I really like about Classic Shell, when you click the start button, you have an apps option and a programs option, and they are very different. The programs are the traditional programs that we're used to running under Windows 7, Windows XP. Apps are those programs specifically designed for the Metro interface. Just one of those little tips that I wanted to pass along. I don't think there's time for some email again, so I know it's been a few weeks and the email's starting to pile up, but I promise I will get to that next week. The show next week will be, unless something very big happens that I need to share, I'm going to catch up on all of your email. So with that, I want to thank everybody for downloading and staying subscribed. Please remember to continue to use my Amazon link. That it's very easy to make your purchase from Amazon and help support the Mike Tech Show. The link is amazon.micnation.net. There, your prices will be the same, but a commission comes back and really helps support the show. And I so appreciate all of your support. That's it. And I will see you next week. Same time, same channel. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.